Oba liked the Mord Sith's breasts. They were as nice as any he had ever held. Still, she was quite the unusual woman. He had a feeling that he would learn many new things with her. Her fist came out of nowhere with deadly speed. Oba caught it in the palm of his hand. He closed his fingers tight around her fist, squeezing as he twisted it back, turning her around so that her back was arched and her shoulders pressed against him. She rammed her free elbow toward his middle, but he was expecting it and snatched her forearm, using the momentum to wrench it up behind her so he could gather it up with the fingers of his other hand already holding her other arm. That left him a hand to feel the delights of her feminine form. He slid his free hand around the front of her waist, in under the leather. She twisted with all her strength, trying to get free. She knew how to use leverage to try to wrench out of an opponent's grip, but her strength wasn't anywhere near up to the task. Oba slipped his hand down the front of her skin-tight leather pants, feeling her taut flesh. The vixen drove her heel into his shin. Oba recoiled, crying out, just managing to hold on to her. But then she spun around, ducked under his arms, and broke his grip. Quick as a blink, she was free. Rather than run, she used her momentum to strike at the side of his neck. Oba was able to partially deflect the blow at the last possible instant, but it still hurt. More than that, it angered him. He was tired of playing gentle games. He caught her arm, twisting it around until she cried out. He swept his leg around to knock her feet out from under her first, then threw his full weight into her. Oba roughly wrestled her around as they crashed to the floor, landing on top of her, driving the wind from her lungs. Before she could get a breath, he slammed a good punch into her middle. He could see in her eyes how much it hurt her. He was going to see much more in her eyes before he was done with her. As they struggled on the floor, Oba had the clear advantage and used it. He began tearing at her clothes. She had no intention of making it easy and fought with everything she had. Her fighting, though, was unexpected in Oba's experience. She didn't fight to get away, as other women did. She fought instead to hurt him. Oba knew, then, how desperately she wanted him. He intended to give her the satisfaction she craved, to give her what she had never been able to get from any man before. His powerful fingers pulled up on the top of her leather outfit, but it was cinched tight around her middle with a thick overbelt. The back of the outfit was crisscrossed with a web of tight straps and buckles. It was too strong to rip. Oba managed instead to strip it up past her ribs. The sight of her flesh ignited him. He fought her hands, her feet, even her head, as she tried to butt his face. Despite her best efforts, he managed to yank and tug the bottom of her tight outfit partway down over the curve of her hips. She struggled ever more violently, trying every move she could to hurt him. He could sense that she wanted him so badly she was hardly able to control herself. As he was devoting his attention to trying to get her bottom off, her teeth seized his other forearm. The shock of pain stiffened him. Instead of pulling back, he rammed the arm in her teeth at her, smacking the back of her head against the stone. The second whack against the stone floor took a lot of the fight out of her, and he was able to free his arm. Oba didn't want her unconscious. He wanted her awake. He watched her eyes as he rolled on top of her, forcing his knee between her thighs, and was pleased to see by the way she gritted her teeth, the way her eyes tracked his, that she was indeed aware of him. Cognition was integral to the experience. It was important that she be aware of what was happening to her, of the transformations that would take place in her living body, aware of death, stalking near, waiting, watching. It was essential to Oba that he see all her primal emotions and sensations through her expressive eyes. He licked the side of her neck, back behind her ear, where the fine little hairs felt soft on his tongue. His teeth raked their way back down. Her neck tasted delightful. He knew she liked the feel of his lips and teeth on her, but she had to fight to keep up the pretense, lest he think her promiscuous. It was all part of her game. By the way she struggled, though, he knew how much she itched for him. As he nuzzled her neck, He worked with his other hand to unbuckle his trousers.
"You've always wanted it like this,"
he whispered hoarsely, nearly delirious with his lust for her.
"Yes," she answered breathlessly. "Yes, you understand."
This was new. He had never been with a woman before who was comfortable enough with her own needs to admit them aloud, except through the show of moans and cries. Oba realized that she must be frantic with desire to cast off pretense and confess her true feelings. It drove him crazy with hunger for her.
"Please,"
she panted against the shoulder he had pressed to her jaw, holding her head against the floor.
"Let me help you."
This was definitely new.
"Help me?" "Yes,"
she confided urgently up toward his ear.
"Let me help you unfasten your trousers so that you'll be free to touch me where I need it most."
Oba was eager to oblige her brazen desires. Leaving her to the treasured task of opening his trousers left him free to grope her. She was a delightful creature, a fitting mate to a man like him, a Rawl, almost a prince. He had never had such a wonderfully unexpected and intimate experience. Apparently, knowing that he was royalty drove women delirious with uncontrollable yearnings. Oba grinned at her shameless need while her covetous fingers fumbled at unbuttoning his trousers. He shifted his weight to give her a little room for her work as he leisurely explored her feminine secrets.
"Please,"
she breathed in his ear again as she finally got his trousers undone.
"Let me hold you down there, please."
She was so hot for him that she had completely abandoned her dignity. He had to admit, though, that it didn't put him off. Biting her neck, he grunted his permission for her to go ahead. Oba lifted his hips so she could get at the objects of her lewd desire. He moaned with pleasure as she stretched her lithe body to reach down under him. He felt her long, cool fingers gathering up his most private parts into her lovely hand. Driven by his unrestrained passion for her, Oba bit into her sumptuous neck again. She moaned with the feel of his teeth as she urgently collected his sack together in her greedy hand. He would reward her with the slowest death he could give her. She suddenly wrenched her handful around with such abrupt violence that as Oba jerked up, he went blind with the shock. The lightning jolt of pain was so acute that he couldn't draw a breath. While he was momentarily immobilized by the trauma, she lunged lower and seized him in a more tenacious grip. Without pause, she mercilessly wrung him even more forcibly the second time. His eyes bulged as he convulsed but once, tenting over her, the spasm fixing his muscles into stiff, stark rigidity. His thinking scrambled. He couldn't hear, see, breathe, or even cry out. He was paralyzed, iron-bound in pure agony. Everything was one long, fiery, sharp, twisting pang. It went on without end. His mouth rounded, trying to scream, but no sound came out. It seemed forever before blurred vision started to return, along with jumbled sounds that filled his ringing ears. The room suddenly spun wildly. Tumbling across the stone floor, Oba realized he had been kicked in his side hard enough to drive the remaining wind from him. It was a complete mystery to him. He slammed into the wall and flopped to a stop. He had to pull hard several times before he could draw a breath. The pain lancing his side felt like a cow had kicked him, but it was nothing compared to the searing inferno in his groin. Then Oba saw the guard. The man had come back. That was who had kicked him in the side, him, not her. She was still sprawled on the floor, her lovely flesh exposed in a teasing manner. The guard had a sword to hand. He went to one knee near the woman, checking her with quick glances.
"Mistress Nida, Mistress Nida, are you all right?"
She groaned as she tottered haltingly to her hands and knees while the man, in a crouch, feet spread, watched Oba. He looked like he feared to help her, to even look at her. But he didn't look to fear Oba. Oba lay back against the wall, gathering his wits as he watched the two of them.
She didn't try to cover her hips, her exposed breasts. Oba knew that she was still game for him, but with the guard there, she couldn't show her feelings. She must be insane with lust for him to have provoked him so by what she had done. Oba pushed himself up a bit, getting his wind back, as the feeling began returning to his tingling extremities. He watched the woman, Mistress Nida, the guard had called her, staggering to her feet. Oba lay still, listened to the voice whispering to him as he watched sweat run across her skin. She was divine. He still had much to learn from a woman like this. There were pleasures untold yet to come. Still recovering his strength, Oba rose up, leaning against the wall, watching as she provocatively used the back of one hand to wipe blood from her mouth. With her other hand, she tugged at her leather outfit, trying to cover herself. She was dazed, no doubt by her heady brush with lust, and was unable to get her trembling hands to work right. Having trouble balancing, she staggered sideways a couple of steps. It appeared as if it was all she could do to stand. Oba was surprised that her bones weren't broken considering their brief but vigorous love tussle. There would be time for that. Blood trickled from the love bites on her neck. He noticed that her blonde hair was matted with blood from when he had banged her head against the stone floor. Oba reminded himself to be mindful of his strength, lest he end it prematurely. That had happened before. He had to be careful. Women were delicate. Oba, still panting to catch his breath, still hobbled by the throbbing ache between his legs, fixed his gaze on the guard. The man had remarkable control to stand there so confidently, considering that he was in the presence of a Rahl. Their gazes met. The man took a step forward. The eyes of the voice opened to look at him, too. The man froze. Oba grinned. "Mistress Nida?" the guard whispered, his eyes staring fixed on Oba. "I think you'd better get out of here." She frowned at him as she tried to pull her leather up over her shapely hips. She was still having trouble balancing, and trying to tug her outfit back into place wasn't helping. "We don't want her to leave," Oba said. The guard's wide eyes stared. "We don't want her to leave," Oba said again, in unison with the voice. "We can both enjoy her." "We don't want her to leave," the guard repeated. Pausing in her attempt to cover herself, Mistress Nida looked from the guard to Oba. "Bring her to me," Oba commanded, amazed at what the voice could think of, and delighted by the very notion. "Bring her over here, and we will both have her." The woman, still unsteady, followed Oba's gaze to the guard. When she saw his face, she tried to snatch her dangling red rod. The guard seized her wrist, preventing her from getting at it. His other hand swept around her waist. She fought him, but he was a big man, and she was already woozy. Oba grinned as he watched the guard dragging the struggling Nida closer. The man's fingers roamed over her exposed flesh as Oba's had done. "She feels delightful, don't you think?" Oba asked. The guard smiled and nodded as he wrestled the woman toward the back of the prison cell where Oba and the voice waited. When they were close enough, Oba reached for her. It was time he finished what he had started. Finished it good. She seized the guard's clothes in her fists for support. With stunning speed, her whole body twisted in midair. From nowhere, for just an instant, Oba saw the bottom of the heel of her boot flying at his face like a bolt of lightning. Before he could react, the world went black amid a stunning crash of pain. Chapter 43. Oba opened his eyes to darkness. He was lying on his back on a stone floor. His face throbbed in pain. He drew his knees up and comforted his aching groin. That vixen Nida had proven as troublesome as any woman he had ever known. It seemed like he was always being tormented by troublesome women.
They were all jealous of him, of his importance. They were all trying to keep him down. Obah was getting weary of waking up in cold, dark places, too. He had hated the way throughout his life he was always waking up in some confined place. They were always hot or cold. No place he had ever been locked in was ever comfortable. He wondered if his lunatic mother, or the troublesome sorceress, Lathea, or her swamp witch sister, had something to do with this. They were selfish and certain to be bent on revenge. This had all the markings of a vindictive act by that pompous trio. But they were dead. Obah wasn't entirely certain that death protected him from those three harpies. They were devious in life. Death wasn't likely to have reformed them. The more he thought about it, though, he had to admit that this was most likely entirely the doing of that vixen in red leather, Nida. She had cleverly pretended to be dizzy and disoriented until the guard had brought her close enough to strike. And then she had kicked him. She was something. It was hard to hold a grudge against a woman who wanted him so badly. The thought of not having Obah exclusively probably drove her to it. She wanted to be alone with him. He supposed he couldn't blame her. Now that he had publicly acknowledged his royal standing, Obah had to recognize that there would be women of such intense passions who would want what he had to offer. He had to be prepared to live up to the demands of being a true Rahl. Groaning in pain, Obah rolled over. With the aid of his hands pushing first against the floor and then a wall, he was finally able to lever himself upright. His own discomfort would only heighten the pleasures of the eventual conquest of his concubine. He had learned that somewhere. Maybe the voice had told him. He saw a small slit of light, much smaller than the opening in the door, in the last place, but it at least helped him to get his bearings. Feeling along the cold stone walls, he began to take stock of the room. Almost immediately, he came to a corner. He moved his hand sideways from the corner along the rough stone of the wall, and was alarmed when he shortly came to another corner. With increasing urgency, he traced the walls and was horrified to discover how tiny the room was. He must have been lying corner to corner, for it wasn't large enough for him to lie down any other way. The suffocating terror of such a small place welled up, threatening to smother him. He couldn't get his breath. He pressed a hand to his throat, trying mightily to pull a breath. He was certain he would go mad being confined in such a small pen. Maybe it wasn't Nida after all. This did have all the marks of his insidious mother's doing. Perhaps she had been watching from the world of the dead, gleefully conniving, plotting how she could harass him. The troublesome sorceress had probably helped her. The swamp witch had no doubt butted in to offer her assistance. Together, the three women had managed to reach out from the world of the dead and help the vixen Nida lock him back in a tiny place. He raced around the cramped little room, feeling the walls, terrified that they were shrinking in toward him. He was too big to be in such a small room, where he couldn't even breathe. Fearing he might use up all the air in the room and then slowly suffocate, Obah threw himself against the door and pressed his face up against the opening, trying to suck in the outside air. Weeping with self-pity, Obah wanted nothing so much at that moment as to bash his lunatic mother's head in all over again. After a time, he listened to the voice counseling him, reassuring him, calming him, and began gathering his wits. He was smart. He had triumphed over all those who had conspired against him despite how evil they were. He would get out. He would. He had to pull himself together and act up to his station in life. He was Obah Rahl. He was invincible. Obah put his eyes up to the slit to peer out, but he could see little more than another dim space beyond. He wondered if maybe he was in a box inside a box, and for a time he pounded at the door, screaming and crying at the terror of such a sinister torture. How could they be so cruel? He was a Rahl. How could they do this to an important person? Why would they treat him this way? First, they locked him up as a common criminal. in with the scum of humanity for doing the right thing and dispensing justice to rid the land of a lawless thief, and now this wicked persecution. Oba concentrated, putting his mind to something else. He remembered then the look on Nida's face when she had first gazed into his eyes. She had recognized him for who he was. Nida had known the truth, that he was the son of Darkenrall, just by looking into his eyes. Small wonder she wanted him so badly. He was important. Selfish people were like that. They wanted to be near those who were great, and then they wanted to keep them down. She was jealous. That was why he was locked up. Petty jealousy. It was as simple as that. Oba pondered that look in Nida's eyes when she had first seen him. The look of recognition on her face had sparked memories that enabled him to put odd bits together. He mulled over the new things he had learned. Jensen was his sister. They were both holes in the world. It was too bad she was kin. She was seductively beautiful. He thought her ringlets of red hair were quite bewitching, even if he worried that they might signify some magical ability. Oba sighed as he pictured her in his mind. He was too principled to consider her as a lover. They shared the same father, after all. Despite her ravishing looks and the way thinking of her made his groin wake, if painfully, his integrity wouldn't allow such a breach of decency. He was Oba Rall, not some rutting animal. Darkenrall had fathered her, too. That was a wonder. Oba wasn't sure what he thought about that. They shared a bond. The two of them stood against a world of jealous people who wanted to keep them from greatness. Lord Rall sent quads to hunt her, so she would have no loyalty there. Oba wondered if it could be that she might be a valuable ally. On the other hand, he recalled the anxiety in her eyes when she looked at him. Maybe she recognized in his eyes who he was, that he, too, was the son of Darkenrall like she was. Maybe she already had plans of her own that didn't include him. Maybe she was upset that he existed. Maybe she, too, would be an adversary, intent on having it all for herself. Lord Rall, their own brother, wanted to keep them down because they were both important. That much seemed likely. Lord Rall didn't want to share all the riches that rightfully belonged to Jensen and Oba. Oba wondered if Jensen would be as selfish. After all, such selfish tendencies seemed to run in the family. How Oba had avoided that wicked aspect of heritage was a wonder. Oba felt his pockets, recalling as he did so that he had done the same thing when he had been in the other room with the criminals, but his pockets were empty. Lord Rawl's people had stripped him of his wealth before locking him away. They had probably taken it for themselves. The world was full of thieves, all after Oba's hard-earned wealth. Oba paced as best he could in such a confined space, trying not to think of how small it was. All the while he listened to the voice advising him. The more he listened, the more things made sense to him. More and more items on the mental lists he kept began falling into place. The grand tapestry of lies and deception that had so afflicted him knitted itself together into a broader picture. And solutions began to solidify. His mother had known all along, of course, how important Oba really was. She had wanted to keep him down from the first. She had locked him in his pen because she was jealous of him. She was jealous of her own little boy. She was a sick woman. Lethea had known, too, and had conspired with his mother to poison him. Neither had the bold nerve to simply do away with him. They weren't that kind. They both hated him for his greatness and enjoyed making him suffer, so their plan from the first appeared to have been to poison him slowly. They called it a cure, so as to soothe their guilty consciences. All along, his mother wore him down with menial chores, treated him with contempt, heaped endless scorn on him, and then sent him to Lethea to retrieve his own poison. Loving son that he was, he had gone along with their devious plans, trusting in their words, their instructions, never suspecting that his mother's love was a cruel lie, or that they might have a secret plan. The bitches, the conniving bitches, they had both gotten what they deserved. And now Lord Rawl was trying to hide him, to deny to the world that he existed. Oba paced, thinking it through. There was too much he still didn't know. After a time he calmed, and did as the voice told him. He went to the door and put his mouth near the opening. He was, after all, invincible.
I need you,
he spoke into the darkness beyond. He didn't shout the words, he didn't have to, because the voice inside, added to his own, would make it carry.
Come to me,
he said into the quiet emptiness outside the door. Oba was surprised by the calm confidence, the authority in his own voice. His endless talents amazed him. It was only to be expected that those less endowed would resent him.
Come to me,
he and the voice spoke into the empty darkness beyond. They had no need to yell. The darkness effortlessly bore their voices, like shadows traveling on wings of gloom.
Come to me,
he said, bending unsuspecting inferior minds to his will. He was Oba Rawl. He was important. He had important things to do. He couldn't stay in this place and play their petty games. He had had enough of this nonsense. It was time to assume the mantle of not just his birthright, but his special nature.
Come to me,
he said, their voices oozing through the dark cracks of the deep dungeon. He kept calling, not loudly, for he knew they could hear him, not urgently, for he knew they would come, not desperately, for he knew they would obey. Time passed, but did not matter, for he knew they were on their way.
Come to me,
he murmured into the still darkness, for he knew that a softer voice yet would draw them in. Off in the distance he heard the faint answer of footsteps.
Come to me,
he whispered, enthralling those beyond to listen. He heard a door in the distance, grate open. The footsteps grew louder, closer.
Come to me,
he and the voice cooed. Closer still he heard men shuffling along a stone floor. A shadow in the dim light fell across the small opening in the door beyond.
What is it?
A man asked, his echoing voice tentative.
You must come to me, Oba told him.
The man hesitated at so pure and innocent a declaration.
Come to me now,
Oba and the voice commanded with deadly authority. As Oba listened, the key in the far lock turned. The heavy door rasped open. A guard stepped into the space between the doors. The shadow of the other guard filled the outer doorway. The guard edged closer to the small slit where Oba waited on the other side. Wide eyes peered in.
What do you want?
The man asked, in a hesitant voice.
We wish to leave now,
Oba and the voice said.
Open the door. It is time for us to go from here.
The man bent forward and worked at the lock until the bolt snapped back with a metallic clang that echoed in the darkness. The door pulled back, squeaking on rusty hinges. The other man stepped up behind him, looking in with the same lifeless expression.
What would you like us to do?
The guard asked, his eyes unblinking as he stared into Oba's eyes.
We must leave,
Oba and the voice said. You two will guide us out of here. Both guards nodded and turned to lead Oba away from the dark pen. He would never again be locked in confining little places. He had the voice to help him. He was invincible. He was glad that he had remembered that. Althea had been wrong about the voice. She was just jealous like all the others. He was alive and the voice had helped him. She was just dead. He wondered how she liked that. Oba told the two guards to lock the doors of his empty cell. That would make it more likely that it would be a while before he was discovered missing. He would have a small head start to escape Lord Rawl's greedy grasp. The guards led Oba through a labyrinth of narrow, dark passageways. The men moved with unerring steps, avoiding those halls where Oba could hear men talking in the distance. He didn't want them to know he was leaving. Better if he simply slipped away without a confrontation.
I need my money back,
Obaa said. Do you know where it is?
Yes, one of the guards said in a dead voice.
They went through iron doors and onward through passageways lined with coarse stone blocks. They turned down a passageway where there were men in cells to each side, coughing, snickering, cursing through the openings in the doors. When they approached the row of doors, filthy arms reached out, clawing the air. As the somber guards carrying lamps led the way down the center of the wide hall, men grabbed for them or spat at them or cursed them. As Obaa passed, the men all fell silent. The arms drew back through the openings. Shadows trailed behind Obaa like a dark cape. The three of them, Obaa and his escort of two guards, reached a small room at the bottom of narrow, twisting stairs. One guard led Obaa up the stairs while the other followed. At the top, they took him into a locked room and then through another locked door. The lamps the guards carried in cast angular shadows through the rows of shelves heaped with things, clothing, weapons, and various personal possessions, everything from canes to flutes to puppets. Obaa scanned the shelves crammed with odd things, stooping to look low, stretching up on his tiptoes to check the upper shelves. He guessed that all these things were taken from prisoners before they were locked away. Near the end of one row, he spotted the handle of his knife. Behind the knife was a mound of the tattered clothes that he had taken from Althea's house so that he could make it across the Azrith Plains. His boot knife was there, too. Piled in front were the cloth and leather pouches containing his considerable fortune. He was relieved to have his money back. He was even more relieved to once again curl his fingers around the smooth wooden handle of his knife.
You two will be my escorts, Obaa informed the guards.
Where shall we escort you? One asked.
Obaa mulled over the question.
This is my first visit. I wish to see some of the palace.
He restrained himself from calling it his palace. That would come in time. For now there were other matters that must come first. He followed them up stone stairwells, through corridors and past intersections and myriad flights of stairs. Patrolling soldiers off in the distance saw his guards and paid little attention to the man between them. When they came to an iron door, one of his guards unlocked it, and they stepped through into a corridor beyond with a polished marble floor. Obaa was taken by the splendor of the hall, the fluted columns to the sides, and the arched ceiling. The three of them marched onward, around several corners lit by dramatic silver lamps hung in the center of marble panels. The hall turned again to open into a grand courtyard of such staggering beauty that it cast the hall they had been in, that had been the finest place Obaa had ever seen, as little more than a pigsty by contrast. He stood motionless, his mouth hanging, as he stared out at a pool of water open to the sky with trees, growing on the other side, as if it were a woodland pond, except that this was indoors, and the pond was surrounded by a low bench-like enclosure of polished, rust-colored marble, and the pond was lined with blue glazed tiles. There were orange fish gliding through the pond, real fish, real orange fish, indoors. In his whole life, Obaa had never been so struck dumb by the grandeur, the beauty, the sheer majesty of a place.
"Is this the palace?" he asked his escorts.
"Only a tiny part of it," one answered.
"Only a tiny part?"
Obaa repeated in astonishment.
"Is the rest as nice as this?"
"No. Most places are much more grand, with soaring ceilings, arches, and massive columns between balconies."
"Balconies? Inside?"
"Yes. People on different levels can look down on lower levels, down on grand courtyards and quadrangles." "On some levels, vendors sell their wares," the other man said. "Some areas are public areas. Some places are quarters for soldiers or staff. There are some places where visitors may rent rooms."
Obaa took this all in as he stared at the well-dressed people moving through the place, at the glass, marble, and polished wood.
"After I've seen some more of the palace,"
he announced to his two big uniformed Dharan escorts,
I will want a quiet and very private room, luxurious, mind you, but some place out of the way where I won't be noticed. I will first want to purchase some decent clothes and some supplies. You two will stand watch and make sure that no one knows I'm here while I have a bath and get a good night's rest.
How long will we be watching you? The other man asked. We will be missed if we're away for too long. If we're gone even longer, they will search for us and find your empty cell. Then they will come looking for you. They will soon know you are here.
Oba considered. Hopefully I can leave tomorrow. Will you be missed by then?
No, one of the two said, his eyes empty of everything but the desire to do Oba's bidding. We were just leaving at the end of our guard watch. We shouldn't be missed before tomorrow.
Oba smiled. The voice had chosen the right man. By then, I'll be on my way. But until then, I should enjoy my visit and see some of the palace.
Oba's fingers glided over the handle of his knife. Maybe tonight I might even like the company of a woman at dinner. A discreet woman. Both men bowed. Before he left, Oba would leave the two as nothing more than a stain of ashes on the floor of a lonely passageway. They would never tell anyone why his cell was empty. And then, well, it was nearly spring. And in spring, who could tell where his fancy might turn? One thing was for sure. Sooner or later, he was going to have to find Jensen. But the voice would help him with that, among other things.
Chapter 44. Jensen's astonishment was wearing off. She was becoming numb to the sight of the endless expanse of men like some dark flood of humanity across the bottomland. The vast army had churned the broad plain between the rolling hills to a drab brown. Inestimable numbers of tents, wagons, and horses were crowded in among the soldiers. The drone of the horde, cut through with yelling, hoots, calls, whistles, the rattle of gear, the clatter of hooves, the rumble of wagons, the ringing rhythm of hammers on steel, the squeals of horses, and even occasional odd cries and screams of what almost sounded to Jensen like women, could be heard for miles. It was like gazing down on some impossibly huge city, but without buildings or pattern, as if all of man's ingenuity, order, and works had magically vanished, with the people left behind reduced to near savages under the gathering dark clouds, trying to make do against the forces of nature and having a grim time of it. Nor was this the worst of the conditions Jensen had seen. Several weeks before, and farther to the south, she and Sebastian had passed through the very place where the army of the Imperial Order had wintered. An army of this size wore heavily on the land, but she had been shocked at how much worse it was when they stopped for any length of time. It would be years before that vast, festering wound in the landscape healed. Worse still, throughout the long, harsh winter, men by the thousands had fallen ill. That dismal place would be forever haunted by an endless expanse of haphazardly placed graves, marking those left behind when the living had marched on. It was horrifying to see such a staggering loss of life to sickness. Jensen feared to imagine the far worse carnage to come in the battle for freedom. With the frost finally out of the ground, the muddy soil had dried and firmed enough that the army had at last been able to strike out from those befouled winter quarters to start their drive toward Adendril, the seat of power in the Midlands. Sebastian had told her that the force they brought up from the old world was so huge that while the leading edge was stopping here to set up camp, it would be hours before those at the tail end caught up and halted for the night. In the morning, the head of the great army would have to start off stretching itself out long before the end could have room to begin to move. While their spring march north was not yet swift, their advance was inexorable. Sebastian said that once the men smelled their prey, their pulse and their pace would quicken. It was a terrible shame that Lord Rawl's greed for conquest and rule made all this necessary, that such a peaceful valley should be given over to men at war. With spring, the grasses were at last coming back to life, so that the hills rising up to each side of the valley looked as if they were covered in living green velvet.
Forests took over on the steeper slopes beyond the hills. In the distance, off to the west and north, stone peaks still wore heavy mantles of snow. Headwaters, swollen with the snowmelt, roared down the rocky slopes and, farther to the east, emptied into a mighty river that meandered out into a great lush plain. The dirt there was so black, so fertile, that Jensen imagined even rocks planted there might sprout roots and grow. Before she and Sebastian had come upon the vast stain of the army, the land had been as beautiful as any Jensen had seen in all her life. She longed to explore those enchanting forests, and fancied she could contentedly spend the rest of her life among such timber. It was hard for her to cast the Midlands as a place of evil magic. Sebastian had told her that those woods were dangerous places where beasts roamed, and where those who wielded magic lurked. With the things she was learning, she was almost tempted to risk it. She knew, though, that even in those trackless and seemingly endless forests, Lord Rawl would still find her. His men had already demonstrated their ability to locate her, in even the most remote areas. Her mother's murder was only the first proof of that. Ever since that terrible day, his merciless assassins had somehow been able to hound her up through Dahara and halfway across the Midlands. If Lord Rawl's men caught her, they would take her back to the dungeons where Sebastian had been held, and then Lord Rawl would have her tortured endlessly before he granted her a slow, agonizing death. Jensen could have no safety, no peace, as long as Lord Rawl pursued her. She intended to catch him instead and seize a life for herself. Another clot of sentries spotted her and Sebastian riding over the open ground and moved down the slope from their observation post at the top of a hill to intercept them. When she and Sebastian were closer, and the men saw his spikes of white hair and the casual salute he gave them, they turned and swarmed back up the hill to their campfire and cooking their dinner. Like the rest of the Imperial Order army she had seen, the men were a rough-looking lot, in tattered clothes, furs, and hides. Down in the broad valley, many sat around small campfires outside little tents made of hides or oiled canvas. Most looked to have been set up wherever their owners had found enough space, rather than to any order. Randomly set among the tents were local command centers, mess tables, arms stockpiles, supply wagons, paddocks packed with livestock or horses, tradespeople laboring, and even blacksmiths working at transportable forges. Scattered here and there were small trading markets where men gathered to barter or buy small goods. There were even agitated, angry, raw-boned men standing among the throngs preaching to smatterings of vacant onlookers. What exactly the men were preaching, Jensen couldn't hear, but she had seen men preach before. According to her mother, the tempestuous body language prophesying doom and proselytizing salvation was as unmistakable as it was unchanging. As they rode closer in to the immense encampment, she saw men at their tents occupied with everything from laughing and drinking to working at cleaning weapons and gear. Some men stood in crooked lines, arms thrown over the next fellow's shoulders, singing songs together. Others cooked by themselves, while still others crowded around mess areas waiting to be fed. Some men were occupied with chores and tending animals. She saw some men gambling and arguing. The entire place was dirty, smelly, noisy, and frighteningly confusing. As uncomfortable as she had always felt around crowds, this looked more terrifying even than a fevered nightmare. Descending toward the churning mass of humanity, she wanted to run in the opposite direction. Only her single burning reason for being there, and nothing else, kept her from doing so. She had reached the brink within and crossed over. She had embraced the need to kill and resolved with cold, deliberate calculation to do it. There could be no turning back. The uniforms the soldiers wore were not that uniform, but seemed to be a mismatched collection of leather set with spikes, fur, chainmail, wool cloaks, hides, and filthy tunics. Almost all the burly men she saw were unshaven, grimy, grim. It was readily apparent why Sebastian was so easily recognized and why no one ever challenged him. Yet she remained awed at how, without fail, every man who laid eyes on him gave him a salute,
Sebastian stood out like a swan among maggots. Sebastian had explained how difficult it was to amass a huge army to defend their homeland, and what an arduous undertaking it was to send them on such a long journey. He said they were men far from home with a grisly job to do. They couldn't be expected to look presentable for women folk, or pause in their life and death battles to be mannerly and make tidy camps. These were fighting men. So were Daharan soldiers. These men certainly didn't look anything like Daharan soldiers looked, nor were they as disciplined, but she didn't say so. Jensen could understand, though. As hard as she and Sebastian had been traveling, all the while taking precautions to evade Lord Rawl's men by riding until they nearly dropped with exhaustion, often backtracking and working hard at making false trails, she had little time to worry about looking her best. Added to that, it had been a long and difficult journey across mountains in winter. It often rankled her that Sebastian should see her with her hair all tangled, when she was as filthy and sweaty as her horse and smelled no better. Still, he never seemed fazed by her all too often unkempt appearance. Rather, he usually seemed ignited by the mere sight of her, and often wanted nothing so much as to do whatever he could to please her. The previous day, they had taken a shorter route across hill country in order to make their way toward the head of the army, and had come across an abandoned farmhouse. Sebastian had indulged her wish to stay there for the night, even though it was early to make camp. After bathing and washing her long hair in the old tub in the tiny washroom, she put the water to use to wash out her clothes. Sitting before the warm fire Sebastian had built in the hearth, Jensen brushed her hair as it dried. She was nervous about meeting the Emperor and wanted to look presentable. Sebastian, leaning back on an elbow, watching her before the flickering glow of flames, had smiled that wonderful smile of his and said that, even if she went unwashed and with tangled hair, she would be the most beautiful woman Emperor Jigang had ever seen. Now, as they rode across the fringes of the Imperial Order encampment, her stomach was in knots, even if her hair was not. From the looks of the turbulent clouds moving in past the mountains to the west, a spring storm would be on them before long. Off above distant valleys, lightning flickered through the dark clouds. She hoped the rain didn't arrive to drench her hair and dress right before meeting the Emperor. "There," Sebastian said, leaning forward in his saddle to point. "Those are the Emperor's tents, and those of his important advisors and officers. Not far beyond, up the valley, will be Aiden Drill itself." He looked over with a grin. "Emperor Jigang hasn't moved to take the city yet. We've made it in time." The huge tents were an imposing sight. The largest was oval, its tri-peaked roof pierced by three lofty center poles. The tent's sides bore brightly colored panels. Standards and tassels hung from the eaves. High atop the three poles, colorful yellow and red banners flapped in the gusty wind, while long pennants streamed out, undulating like airborne serpents. The Emperor's congregation of tents stood out among the drab little quarters of the regular soldiers the way a king's palace towered over surrounding huts. Jensen's heart raced as they urged their horses down into the thick of the encampment. Both Rusty and Pete, their ears alert, snorted their misgivings about entering such a noisy and busy place. She urged Rusty ahead in order to take Sebastian's hand when offered it. "Your hand is all sweaty," he said, smiling. "You aren't nervous, are you?" She was water at a boil, a horse at a gallop. "Maybe a little," she said, but her purpose stiffened her will. "Well, don't be. Emperor Jigang will be the one to be nervous, meeting such a beautiful woman."